We're going to move on to the panel session now. What we'd like to do is make this as interactive as possible. So you chaps down, people down there are a little bit of a disadvantage, can't see you that well, but if you put your hand up, there are people with microphones that can get to you. So if you've got a question, just put your hand up and get our attention and just join in the conversation, please. Very briefly, on my immediate right is Jonathan Woodward, Head of Transaction Sales at Refinitiv. Stuart Simmons is Senior Portfolio Manager at QIC. Lee Merchant is Head of Global Foreign Exchange at Deutsche Bank in Sydney. And I think most of you know Guy DeBell, who is Deputy Governor of the RBA and Chair of the Global Foreign Exchange Committee. I thought we'd start off, I mean, Cathy mentioned the three-year review there, Guy. So as you look ahead to that three-year review, what do you think are the key issues? I mean, clearly ASIC's got an issue or two they want.
Yeah.
How do you see it?
We've been getting a fair bit of advice via a number of publications, including your own, over the last few weeks about what we should be considering, which is great because we're actually looking for input as to what people think we should be looking at in the three-year review. We are at the moment in through the various foreign exchange committees, or from now till the end of next month, looking at as much feedback from market participants as to what they think we should look at. So we're actually really asking for people to come to us and tell us what we should be looking at across the various jurisdictions. And we will be talking to the various securities regulators around the world. Some of them may have already had conversations with them as to what they think we should be looking at too. So, and when you and I talked about this in recent edition of Profit and Loss, I mean, some of the areas which we clearly are focusing on, and some of which are already out there. So anonymous trading is one clear area of focus. I think since, you know, coming up on three years since we launched the code, but, you know, 5 years since we started the process. So over that 5 years, you know, that's become a much larger part of the market. And so you, Cathy mentioned about the code being a living document, and so it was always going to evolve as the market structure evolved. Well, that's an area where the market structure has evolved, and we need to address that. You know, few people are interested in last look, I believe.
I honestly thought we'd done that one 3 years ago.
Yeah. So, I think so. As maybe most of you know, so when we that was the first area we sort of went out and was. I'm not allowed to use the word consulted because my New York friends don't like using that word. But we asked people's opinion about last look, and we got plenty of feedback on that. But as it's gone on, I think that's clearly an area where we need to revisit. I don't necessarily want to re-prosecute the same arguments that we prosecuted at great length a few years ago, but there are issues around, I think, things like hold time. Cathy mentioned trade rejection and that information and how people utilise that. I think is something we will probably need to reconsider. The other area that Cathy mentioned is pre-hedging.
I've got a few dozen questions on that one.
Yeah. So, I mean, we spent a hell of a lot of time on pre-hedging, and it's not easy to land. And right. I don't claim that we have what we have here. And is there scope to provide more context around what we've got? Yes, I think that's absolutely the case, and so that is clearly something else that will be very much be in scope in the 3-year review. So, at least in my view, I think clearly, I mean, anonymous trading is absolutely something we've already said we're going to do, but last look and pre-hedging, I think, are clearly something we're going to focus on. At the same time, the balance, just to make it clear to people, if you've, you know, I hope you've all signed up to the code, but if in signing up to the code, you can't have this thing changing every 6 months, right? Otherwise, you're not clear what the hell you signed up to.
Well, frankly, it doesn't need changing.
No, but so that was what I was going to, I would say this, cause having written a decent chunk of it, I actually think it's pretty good, but that aside, I do, you know, we arrived at the... at this after a pretty extensive process over 2 years, getting thousands of people's input on it, and that, you know, this is where we landed. So I think most of it is I think fit for purpose. And so I suppose what I'm trying to do is give people assurance that what we aren't about to do is rewrite the whole thing wholesale. Yeah. Amongst other things, I just, having done that once, I just don't think I can do that again in my life. But we aren't going to do that. What we are going to do is it is going to evolve, but in a way where in the areas where it needs to, and we're not revisiting. It is not the intent to revisit the thing sort of principle by principle,
no.
But just focus on a few key areas where there are still clearly issues in the market, and also areas where market practice has moved on.
Lee, can I bring you in on something that Cathy brought up actually in her speech there that kind of bothered me? It was around pre-hedging, so we might as well get straight to it. The kind of intent I got was, well, you need a structure for pre-hedging. Markets change minute by minute. How easy or difficult is it to actually establish a pre-hedging firm structure? Or does it have to be a broader policy within which you operate?
Well, as Guy said, when we were writing the code, it is a difficult thing to land. So when you have the principle set out as it is, then you have to look at the vast array of your business where pre-hedging may be utilised to benefit the client outcome.
Yeah.
One of those I think that Cathy specifically mentioned was pre-hedging of stop-loss orders. Now, there's a number of ways that a bank may execute a stop-loss order, as in methods, electronically invoicing are predominantly the two most common. And so then you need to set out guidance for your staff, because not only is my responsibility, my bank's responsibility to its client base, it's also got a responsibility to its traders, to protect its traders in practices which are condoned and common in the marketplace. So if we go back to stop losses, then you have to strip out the ways that a stop loss can be executed. You have to set pretty clear guidance. I mean, I would say our Deutsche Bank order handling policy is probably actually has more detailed guidance than the code at this point in time. We have obviously a surveillance ring around that monitors the practice of actually when an order hits the trading blotter, i.e. when it's been executed, what trading activity has actually taken place around that, so that same time to monitor the particular type of pre-hedging that we condone and the code condones has taken place.
Is there also an education issue here with some clients where you've actually got to educate the clients about the benefits to them of pre-hedging certain orders?
To be honest, no. Pre-hedging of a stop loss specifically is for the large majority of the client base, especially that Deutsche Bank trades with, a practice that was known, regarded, and expected in some way. I mean, clients, when you look at a client demand around a stop loss, a client obviously is asking the bank to do two things. One, to basically minimise the chance that the client will unfortunately get stopped out in the market, and therefore applying protection for that, making sure that the market is trading observing that the market has traded through the level in a fair and relative manner.
Yeah.
And then also minimising the cost of that stop loss on top, as in the fill rate.
Which is really what it's about, isn't it? Yeah, because it's about the slippage after the order, exactly. Is why you're pre-hedging it. Stuart, from your point of view, actually, as a buy-side trader, I mean, obviously, you execute larger tickets over a period of time, which in some ways could be assisted pre-hedging. What's your view in terms of the pre-hedging debate?
You talk about education in pre-hedging, and I think that where the buy side could be educated around pre-hedging is the type of orders that they give. Because there might be some naivety about the scenarios where pre-hedging comes in, particularly around benchmarks. If you leave a very large order for a London 4 p.m. fix, by necessity, it needs to get pre-hedged. You cannot execute at the fix.
Funny, we could explain that to a New York jury.
Yeah. How long we would take to get to that point with you and minutes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there needs to be a sense of education around, you know, those circumstances.
Yeah.
And what the expectations can be around it.
But generally it's about the transparency of action, isn't it? It's about as long as the executing party is clear with you what they're doing, then
yeah, absolutely.
Generally speaking, it should be okay.
Yeah.
Anonymous trading, Jonathan.
Yes.
What stick would you like me to beat you with? With a matching stick or anonymous? What are the challenges for a platform operator? You know, the disclosures piece that, you know, the guy's talking about around last look and around hold times, but just general behaviour in an anonymous environment.
Yeah,
so there are people out there that think platforms should do more. Do you think platforms could do more?
Well, they're very complex environments, aren't they? So we run a couple of platforms. One is completely firm, one is firm and has last look. So that adds complexities to it straight away. I think the key for the firm, for the venue operator, is really, really proactive monitoring systems that notice what's going on in the market a long, long time before they actually impact it. And that's what we try and do, where we see some certain behaviours sort of picking up from certain clients, certain participants in that market. We will have a conversation with them about that activity. We have a very big rule book that everybody has to comply with. So any breaches of that, there are alerts that come out sort of every few minutes if something is going on, and that enables us to go in and either turn off the access if it really is deemed as creating.
So it's quite an automated process.
It's an automated process from an alert perspective. Yeah. We do like to have a human having a look at that, because otherwise you end up with some very upset people if there was a real good reason for
it. Algos never get it wrong.
No. So maybe AI will be the solution at the end of the day. There you go. I got one in. Yeah. So a little buzzword. I'm not saying blockchain yet.
Right? Take your bingo cards.
So we look at all the ratios, we have alerts, we have a review committee, and we apply different rules to the different venues because they operate in different ways. And we also obviously have disclosed venues that are also under surveillance as well. But the anonymous one is interesting because you really need to have that integrity. And we work very closely with central banks and regulators to make sure that they are completely up to speed if there is anything that might be perceived as creating disorderly market or market abuse, because obviously we're all governed by the EU market abuse regulation. But we'll talk to central banks around the world, and quite often we'll give them the information and it'll come back with a no investigation needed. But I think we're going to get better over time as our technology gets better and everything. I mean, everything's getting faster, isn't it? So there's more data and there's more volume. It's a big challenge.
One man's market abuse is another man's best execution.
Indeed.
So how do you sort of manage that aspect of it? I mean, do you need to really get into the details with the executing party about how they're trading? Or do you leave that to DLPs?
Well, no. So, I mean, so on matching, where it's just market participants and firm, we'll look at all that behaviour and make sure that it actually is, you know, by our rule book, it is allowed and nobody's breaking any rules there. If we see things like we're looking at anticipative IOCs that are trying to come in the middle of the stuff, we'll go and have a chat with that participant and go, you know, what's going on here? Because, if you're in the middle of trades that actually need to get done and then you're disappearing, we don't want that in the market because it's not good for anybody.
Because that's quite a challenge, because there was a paper out, I think it was last year or the year before, that actually said 99% of orders submitted to one of the primary venues were cancelled before execution. Quite a high number.
Yes.
Yeah, but you know, this was actually observed data. You know, it's a research paper. It's available somewhere. Alexis Stenfors, I think, is the author, if you want to look at it.
Okay.
So, Guy, one thing I wanted to raise with you, which comes back to one of your earlier points, is around the disclosures thing. You and I did have a chat a few weeks ago, and you made a point that, you know, one of the things the message you want to get out is around the appropriate nature of disclosures, and not giving everyone basically a free hit. Mm. I mean, do you think that's a widespread problem, or do you think it's just something that just needs everybody to be reminded of?
I mean, obviously there's been a bit of a look at disclosures by some market participants lately, over the last couple of weeks, and a bit of publicity around that. Mm. But I think it comes back to, what are we providing maybe a little more guidance about some of the things we would expect to see in disclosures. I mean, I suppose what I don't think quite cuts it, and I'm not sure I can say about the, how widespread it is, but what I would describe, I think in the way it betrayed it when I was talking to you before, as the caveat emptor disclosure. So, you know, as long as I tell you that I'm going to be trading at the same time as you, then I can basically do whatever I want. That doesn't quite, you know, that doesn't quite cut it to me as an appropriate disclosure. Disclose something, but it's not that's not helpful to me as a counterparty. So I think one of the things I think we'll look at is maybe just, but it's, I mean, I don't think there's any prospect of being prescriptive on disclosures and saying this is exactly what a disclosure should look like, because that is very much going to vary depending on the counterpart.
And that's a problem.
But I think at the same time, I think it'd be useful to have some minimum set of information which is contained in that disclosure, which is useful to any counterparty. And then, I mean, there is then somewhat of an obligation on the counterparty to, if they want to know more, to ask for more, which is relevant to whatever their nature of the engagement.
Because I mean, that is one of the problems. You know, you look at the last look thing, and I honestly cannot believe we're talking about it again. But the fact is, last look is different on different platforms at different times and different times of day. I mean,
I also think last look seems to mean different things to different people as well.
Yes.
Well, are there different environments? I mean, some's last look in a central limit anonymous order book, some's last look on an RFQ. So they're vastly different environments.
At last look on a very infrequently traded currency in coming out of Africa is, you know, a week. And then elsewhere it's, you know, a few milliseconds.
Yeah.
How do you view last look, Stuart? I mean, as a buy side participant.
Yeah, you know, I know some firms are completely against it. I can see some reasons why banks would want to have it there. You know, credit checks, operational checks, and things like that. I think there's a bit more controversy when you go into hold times and things, obviously. You know, we from our firm's perspective, we find our reject rates are exceptionally low. We don't necessarily have a problem with it. I think if someone has reject rates which are higher, they should be asking questions. I mean, we ask questions. We get a list of reject rates from our firms. And, you know, it may be as low as 0.01%. It is tiny.
Yeah. And I guess that's the thing, Jonathan, with the benefit of data. Data allows you to go in and have actually an empirical conversation rather than just, oh, you keep on rejecting me. No, I don't. You keep on sniping me, you know, as it used to be.
Yeah, so the data's key, and we provide, platforms should provide that data on a regular basis to their customers. The stuff that's going over the single bank platforms obviously has to come from the bank and lots of stuff around there. And that enables customers to really have a good conversation with their liquidity providers. But I just wanted to make the point about the difference of environments. Reject rates on an RFQ system, I'll go by the one we are generally around about, 2%. I mean, it's very, very small. It's market moves. But it also comes down to expectations. So we had a client that works, used our order book facility a lot. And his expectation was that he would get 45% rejects because of the nature of the liquidity he was seeking in that environment. And he felt that it was the best platform out there for what he wanted to do. You could go to another guy, get him plugged into that same environment, who gets 5% rejects, who goes up the wall because he thinks it's absolute rubbish. So it does come down to your expectations of what you're actually going to be doing in a particular platform.
Is it easy to manage in a single dealer environment that sort of vast range of expectations of clients?
In a single dealer environment, in a way, yes. I mean, it all depends on how well that you've set up your system so that you can monitor, thousands of clients or thousands of users to hundreds of clients, and how well you can put into place your controls around that. As Jonathan said, we have clients that, their business model simply wouldn't exist if we couldn't employ last look. Right. So as long as we are able to apply that last look, and when I say last look in that sense, I do mean a hold time. If we are able to apply that hold time, in conjunction with the expectation of the client, and we are able to enable their business to grow, then I don't see basically why something should get in the way of that business. But yeah, I mean, it's something that you have to, I say, your question was how difficult it is. From my point of view, it's not difficult because we've done the work to set up the system, I should say. but yeah, you do have to do a lot of groundwork at the beginning to make sure that you set up your system in such a way that you can monitor.
Let alone issue countless disclosures to countless clients.
That as well, yes.
Yeah. And do you actually find disclosures change across channels? You know, is a client dealing predominantly with you by voice or RFS different to an API?
Yes, it is. So at Deutsche Bank now we have, I'd put it into three different categories of disclosure. We have our general Autobahn terms and conditions, which covers the single dealer, and the broad set of terms and conditions that we would interact with a client with over electronic means. More recently, in the last, say, 18 months, we have released something which is specific to API trading. It goes into a lot more detail into things which are quite unique to APIs, you know, things like internet connection, who owns data, whether there's a third party involved, whose responsibility is that third party and stuff like that. And actually, what we found is that they are actually quite difficult to get clients to adhere to in some respects, because, like some parts of the market, API and AI or API trading has raced on and become a lot easier for most people to actually just kind of like call up a provider, plug and play, and go. But the actual understanding of that within the firm who's using that third party or using the API is maybe not as up to speed as where we're taking the conversation in terms of this API agreement. So, we're trying to lead the market in a way to think about these things and finding sometimes it's more difficult than we would have assumed.
I look forward to the 3-year review discussing it. Yeah. API disclosures. Stuart, I want to get onto one of the sort of, I guess it's kind of a stick that critics of the code use to beat it with, and that is buy-side adoption. I think, generally speaking, it's agreed that buy-side adoption has been a bit disappointing globally. Again, returning to our friends in America, I find it fascinating that there's members of their FXC that are still not signed up to the code and they're still on the committee in spite of comments a year ago. Why do you think buy-side adoption has been so slow?
Yeah, and it has been poor, you know, locally and globally, right? I mean, I checked the local register today. There's one corporate and two asset managers and zero pension funds who've signed up. And, you know, there could be more leadership from some of the bigger firms involved, both globally and domestically there. You know, why haven't they signed up? There's a number of reasons. One is about, I mean, firstly, awareness. You know, I've done some outreach on it to speak to different firms, and a number of them still weren't aware of the code's existence. And these are market participants whose main business is not foreign exchange.
Yeah,
they've got bigger things to focus on. The second is really establishing that business case for the code. Mm-hmm. There's a sense that, you know, this is a sell side thing. There's a perception. Yeah. You know, that it's for the sell side around conduct. There's also the what's in it for me type of argument. Operationally, they feel that there's constraints around putting resources into getting adherence to the code. You know, and lastly, I guess there's the sense of facilitation. You know, how do I get started on this? They're unsure on how to pursue that.
Mm.
I mean, I was going to pick up. I mean, Stuart's working on is one of the major drivers of this for the GFXC is trying to address this problem, and we are looking to provide information. He's working on developing that so we can help answer some of those questions. But the other thing we're doing around pretty most of our membership is actually going out and talking to the buy side, both on the asset management side and on the corporate side, and saying, and just trying to understand what some of those sticking points that Stewie just highlighted are, and working either to just explain, though, why we don't think they necessarily are a problem, or if they are, then thinking about how we can best go about addressing it. And so, you know, that is something me and my counterparts around the world are looking at doing over the next 12 months, is actually going out and talking to, particularly to some of the more high-profile ones, and just understanding what is the sticking point, and then trying to address that or convince them otherwise, I suppose.
Yeah, there is a buy-side outreach work group.
Yeah.
Part of the GFXC, and there's been a lot of development, as Guy mentioned, tools and information and helping to establish that business case for the code. I guess half of that's now available on the GFXC website, including a bit of a roadmap to adherence, mm-hmm. presentation on you know, building that business case, the motivations around signing up for the buy side. There is a template for gap analysis. It really helps people, leads them through the adherence of each of those 55 principles. Firstly, determining which of those apply to that market participant, because not all of them do, and proportionality is a really key yeah. issue there. And then there's some more to come. So we're working on other things like pretty big questions and answers, more comprehensive than the one that's there at the moment, case studies from varied market participants in different domiciles, and we're going to be working a lot more in a decentralized way. And as Guy mentioned, you know, locally, the RBA has been doing a lot of work, reaching out to firms and market participants, and we want to work with associations as well to get that message out there and help with that motivational message as well.
I think that's key. The associations part is quite key. And if you work with ACT around the world and they come up with a smaller part of the code, you know, they acknowledge the whole code, but they really focus on the bits that are important for the treasurers. And we're hearing the same thing when we talk to asset managers around the world. There's always another bit of legal or compliance thing that needs to get done before they spend some resources on that.
Yeah, I think Jonathan's point is quite, that's what often the feedback I have. It's like, yeah, okay, we've got fine. It's not that we don't like it, but we've got this, and this, which are more more important for our business, and it's getting where it sits on that priority list. But part of the point we're trying to get across is the proportionality point. Stewie mentioned that some parts of this really there's probably only a reasonably small part which is directly yeah. applicable to you in a way where all 55 principles are applicable to Lee. Mm. And trying to get
he looks delighted at that fact.
Well, I think I think they probably recognise that. That's not news, but trying to get that across, that just focus on the bits which are relevant to you.
Mm. I think the central banks and the regulators could stare at the banks and just eyeball them into signing this.
Well,
right?
I was just staring at Leah.
That was there, but
just that fashion.
But when you think about it, when you want to get the buy side on board, yeah. the investment managers, the people that need to stare at them are going to be the asset owners who've given them the money to say, "Are you complying?" And that's where that bit of.
I mean, I listened to your podcast on this the other day. so you listen, it's one listener.
Live criticism.
You've actually been paying him, okay? What's going on?
Live criticism, just what I need.
No, but I think it's an interesting question you're having with Galen. Is that so? What is is about success or failure? And I think one of the things you've got to, I think, is well, what was, where we are compared to where we were.
Yeah.
And I think if I look at it across the coverage across the industry, so on the sell side, it's large.
Yeah.
On the non-bank liquidity providers, it's pretty high. Mm. On the platforms, it's high. And then yes, it steps down on the buy side, and then a leg lower again on the corporate side. But when you think what you've actually got by the time you've covered the first chunk of what I said, that's a pretty decent chunk of the market. Mm. That doesn't mean that we just say that's great, job done by any means.
I know.
So we are having this focus on the buy side, and to some extent sort of starting at the top and working our way down. And the idea, it's not after getting every single participant in the market signed up. It's getting the appropriate, there's a bit of proportionality on that as well.
Yeah, yeah. Lee, I mean, do you, Is your sense that the execution desks at the client firms understand, you know, the value the code can bring, but it's above that the problem comes? Do you have many conversations with clients around the code? Yes, I'm trying to blame you for not getting it out there.
Let me start by saying, look, I do have sympathy for parts of the buy-side community in terms of, you know, they look at the code, you know, they have certain amounts of legal obligations that they're already on their books, and applying that to their business and being comfortable that they can adhere to it in the way that maybe, you know, they would like to, you know, is something that needs to be, I guess, prioritised. I mean, for example, at Deutsche Bank, we employed one of the big four auditors to look at our business up and down, but then, as Guy did say, every 55 of the principles apply to me. But are there parts of the foreign exchange community where I hear the excuse, you know, it shouldn't apply to us or it doesn't apply to us because of this and that? I don't have a lot of sympathy for that.
No.
I think, you know, if you are trading actively in the foreign exchange market on a daily, weekly basis, then you are part of the market. Mm. And, you know, upon the conduct of us all rests our fate. So, you know, I think those people should feel they have an obligation to join. And, you know, if there are parts of the code that are not to their liking, they feel can be improved or whatever, fine, but get in the tent, i.e. sign up, and have that conversation within rather than throw stones from without.
Mm. I mean, something either struck me, does the message need to get a little bit more, I hesitate to use the word aggressive, but more positive, should we say, when we're reaching out to the buy side? Because I have spoken to some firms, particularly in Europe, where they were saying, well, no, we're actually actively going out to asset owners and investors and saying, we've signed up to the global code. How's the other firm that's looking to do that? That shows that we conduct best practice. Should our message be more about that, Stuart, in terms of like saying, you know what, we're better than these guys?
You know, I think in terms of that message, a lot of the narrative that's going on with the code are things around last look, you know, you hear it now, and cover and deal and anonymous trading. Mm. And for a lot of the buy side, that doesn't really apply to them. You know, they have disclosed relationships, bilateral relationships. They're not really getting hit by last look that much. So sometimes we just need to simplify that message and really articulate the benefits for the code. Mm. And you know, Kathy mentioned some things earlier around order handling, markup, pre-hedging. And the code really helps to demystify that in that bilateral relationship. You can ask the right questions if you're aware of the code and aware of the obligations from the counterparty.
Should we be talking to the compliance compliance teams at these organisations as well? I mean, the banks, I'm sure, are fully on board. But is it actually maybe you reach in from behind by getting the compliance team say, excuse me, what about this global code? What are we doing there?
I mean, I think what our approach is actually to go to the top.
Yeah.
And say, you CEO, it's literally you CEO, you know, you're aware of this, you know, this is something which should, you know, and so get, because I'm not sure going to the compliance areas is always going to help, because I think they look at it, then I think that's where some of these concerns arise, that they say, oh, you know, trying to get across to them the sense of proportionality is, I think, possibly more challenging.
Well, because I guess to the point they deal with regulation most of the time.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so they're going to, I think it, you know, and also trying to get across that this is a, you know, code of good practice rather than black letter regulation is maybe, I'm trying not to be too stereotyping compliance areas here, but
I
think that's something which is hard to, particularly in the current environment, to get across. Maybe something which, it said, our approach has been more to go to the top, right to the top.
I think a knock on the door from compliance is about as welcome as a knock on the door from ASIC, I think, most of the time. One thing I did want to just briefly cover, actually, because recently the FCA in London, in the UK, turned around and actually recognised the code.
Yep.
ASIC recognises the code. Is this a good stepping stone to actually getting more buy-side adoption on the basis that these are your regulators as well as the sell side? And actually, if they're going to come and investigate your business, they are going to be using this as a benchmark. Is there an opportunity for more, hopefully more regulators around the world to take that approach? And do you think it will have, it will help us build that buy-side adoption?
Yes. But actually, it's already outside of the US. It's reasonably well there already. So
it's just a question of going through the process.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's great that the FCA has done that, and I think that will help in exactly the way you just said, and same with ASIC here. I think that's been great in helping that. But it is just getting that. But the message, I think by and large, it's still being seen primarily through the lens of the sell side.
Yeah.
But I really come back to what Lee said earlier. If you're an active participant in the market, you're an active participant in the market, regardless of which part, segment of the market you're looking at. And the sort of turnover you're generating as a large active buy side participant is on a par with a bunch of those other market participants, and so it is actually just as relevant to you as a market participant as it is to Deutsche.
And I think it's fair to say that a lot of the not defending the conduct issues that we had in any way whatsoever, but a lot of them did sort of grow out of the bank's over-eagerness to please certain clients that were actually pushing them into a corner, and maybe the code gives us that sort of responsibility. Does anyone actually have a question for the panel? We're going to close out in just a second. No? We've told you all you need to know. Love it. So let's sort of close out then by asking each of you sort of how you would grade the code's first couple of years as a full document. always go back to school. I mean, generally speaking, from your perspective, Jonathan, how have you seen the code's impact on the market?
Well, I think it's actually just the conversation that it's generated has been really healthy for the whole industry. Because the education of the buy side has been key. I think most of the banks knew about it. I mean, obviously, I live in Singapore and deal with the rest of Asia. I don't think that it's had a vast impact across all those banks there, and a lot of the buy side don't know what's going on. So I think it's been really effective from starting those conversations. I found it a little bit tough with some of the other countries that have adopted the code and then altered it and added to it. And you just want to go, a lot of intelligent people around the world put a lot of time into this. Why have you added five sections? You didn't take anything out, but you added five other things. You attached financial penalties for non-compliance in certain areas, and that will stop adoption of it in various places. But I think it's a really great starting point. I think the three-year review will help, and we need to find ways of putting pressure on the people who can then put pressure on the people that further down that chain that need to adopt it.
Are you happy with how the code's gone, Stuart?
Yeah.
Your business?
I guess in terms of grading, I put an A+ in terms of effort for the people who are really intimately involved in the code, people like Guy who were there from the very beginning. B in terms of its impact on the market, and probably an F for the buy side.
Lee, I mean, from your perspective, how has it impacted how you do your business and your relationship with clients? Has it made it better or...?
I was going to answer this in a slightly different way, actually. I was going to answer it in from the point of view as a manager and leader of people that were trading in foreign exchange and have been trading in foreign exchange, the majority of them, for a number of years. What the code has enabled me to do as a manager and has enabled them to see is, there is something they can refer to now. There is something that they can talk to about their clients, how we go about it, a universally, at this point, accepted compass or moral compass of directions as well. And I think that has done, the world of good for the banking side, especially the traders involved within the marketplace.
And I didn't know is no longer an excuse, is it? It's one of the big things.
Exactly.
I guess, it's like,
What did Jefferson say? Everybody's born ignorant, but you have to work really hard to be stupid.
Where's our live boy?
Code gives that.
So, Guy, from your perspective, I mean, obviously you've come back to this after a two-year hiatus to a degree. I know you were still fully involved, but
I mean, I think there's a couple of things to remember. One was where we were starting from.
Yeah.
So, which I think sometimes gets a bit lost. Secondly, what the alternative was.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of people forget, the alternative was a hell of a lot worse.
Yeah.
And it was a real prospect of that. And thirdly, another lens to assess it by, I think what Lee said is actually a very important lens to think about it from. But another one is actually the impact on market functioning, and which is partly a question of where we were starting from. So when we were starting, no one was willing to talk to anyone in the market and share any information whatsoever. Everything, you know, information flow had just dried up, had pretty much come to a complete halt, and that didn't facilitate effective market functioning. So it was an overshoot to the, you know, basically to the billion-dollar fines. And so part of our interest, on the central banking side at least, in developing was the code to, was to help move the market back to a more effectively functioning market. And on that, I think we can claim some success. Mm. Is there, you know, but it's, and I'm trying to think, what would have been my expectation, whatever, 4 or 5 years ago, whenever we started this? And I don't think it's miles away from where we are today. Again, if I go through that sort of adherence across those different parts of the industry, that's probably about what my priors would have been. That doesn't mean that we say, as I said, job done, that there is still further work to do there. And I suppose the other thing, which I've said a few times in the past, is one thing, you know, is one thing we try to get across is there's a bunch of stuff which is sort of black and there's a bunch of stuff which is white. There's a hell of a lot of grey in the middle. Yeah. And one thing we've tried, and it's always going to be thus, which is why black letter regulation would have been an absolute disaster for the market, which was a real alternative at one point. And what we're trying to do, coming to, back to what Lee just said, is provide that guidance as to what good practice might look like for that grey. There isn't a right or a wrong answer in some of those cases, but this provides you with a framework to try and think about what that answer is. And then having made that decision, being able to say when, you know, your ASICs of the world come knocking on the door, say, well, this is why we did what we did, and here's our motivation for it. And it's like, yep, okay, fine.
Which actually kind of helps the regulator as well in terms of the fact that, you know, there's that quick answer actually allows them to spend less time in someone's office they don't want to be in.
Yeah.
Yeah. One last chance for any question? No, we're good. Okay, well, I'd like to thank Invest Global and Refinitiv for sponsoring this evening. On behalf of ACU Australia, we hope you enjoyed it. Our thanks to our speakers.
Before we go, though, feedback on the three-year review, please. You can get in touch with me, get in touch with Matt Bogue, who most of you know, or Jason Griffin. So Matt's effectively the secretary of the GFXC these days, and Jace is the secretary of the AFXC. So any of the three of us, very happy to receive feedback.
And details at globalfxc.org.
Well, I think we know where we live. but what we would ask though is if people could provide that basically over the next 6-8 weeks or so, that would be great. We're certainly talking about it at the next AFXC meeting. But you know, people here in this room aren't necessarily members of the AFXC. Please, very happy to hear the feedback from anyone across the industry.
So, Lee hasn't got enough to do at the moment.
Yeah, but anyway, sorry to interrupt your...
No, that's us. Thank you very much. Thank you again to our sponsors. Hope you enjoyed our evening. Refreshments are available, I believe, where they were to start with. Thanks to our panellists.